Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, football fans, it's Andrew Filippone, host of the First and Pod podcast. Join me and my co-host, three-time All-Pro Patrick Peterson, as we break down every game every week. New episodes drop on Monday and Friday mornings. Be sure to subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Highs of 78 today, a lot of clouds. It's been the kind of days where the smell of fried foods hangs heavy in the air. Have y'all noticed that or not? It's like where you can smell if Popeye's is cooking chicken around a block or whatever. It just hangs. I don't know why. Right now it's 65 throughout the weekend. Highs of 77 tomorrow, 77 Saturday, and Sunday 78. So I don't know if it's going to clear up any or not, but there's your deal. In the treasure chest, the virtual treasure chest casino power seat now, live from the host committee's media center on Radio Row in a convention center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. That's where David Beer finds himself, director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute, to talk about the Trump administration and what's going on with immigration. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the Trump administration, what they're trying to do, and where the court action stands on this.
Well, they're trying to do a lot of different things on immigration, as you know. So you have the birthright citizenship order, which is probably the biggest, hottest item on there. That's been enjoined by multiple courts at this point. That item obviously restricts birthright citizenship to the children of people who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents of the United States. So that includes people who are here legally under temporary visas, as well as people who are here illegally. And then you look at, you know, some of the other items that they're working on, the invasion declaration at the border. They're removing people who cross illegally without, basically as soon as they catch them, they're putting them on planes. So that's their item at the border. And then when you look at what's happening in the interior of the United States, you have an increase in the number of arrests of people, and that's what they're kind of advertising and putting out there on social media, all the people who are being arrested. But at this point, although there's been twice as many arrests, there have been fewer removals of those people so far. So they're removing people at the border, but they haven't really got to remove very many people from the interior of the United States.
See, and that's what I wanted to talk to you about the perception as opposed to the reality of what's being billed or how's it being branded and what's actually happening, because we heard about mass deportation. People that were in favor of that were happy about it. People that were opposed to it were terrified about it. But where's the truth of it in terms of what's actually happening or what's actually likely to happen?
Yeah, so they're arresting about 600 people a day. So if you do the math on that, we'll be have mass deported, or at least mass arrested, 11 million people in a few decades. So at the current pace, we're not nearly close to, you know, a level of where we would even be arresting enough people to mass deport everyone here illegally. And then if you look at the removals, you know, they're not getting these people onto planes and flying them out of the country. At this point, it's a process. They're not. No. Most of the people who they have arrested in the interior have not been removed. And they're either in detention, but many of them have been released into the United States again to await, their process for removal.
Wait a minute. Let me take a break, and we'll pick it up when we come back. And maybe I'll approach it a different way, David, which is, and I think I already know the answer, but I'm going to approach it this way, which is, okay, so what's changed really despite all the promises, and what's likely to change in the future despite all the promises? We're talking to David Beer. Our friend, he's the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute. We're broadcasting live from the host committee's media center on Radio Row in the convention center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. I'm Tommy Tucker. This is WWL. Back in a flash. Time for traffic now. All right, here we go. Tommy Tucker, WWL 624, talking to David Beer, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute. We're at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in a convention center powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. For the big game, David Beer, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, is in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino Power Seat. Let's talk about these texts that I'm getting. I'm going to read them to you, all right, David? This guy's spreading misinformation. They're definitely being flown out. I've seen it with my own eyes. I don't know where this person's seen it or whatever. Somebody else said that all of people loaded up on a military plane in Dallas last week was a fake video. I don't know what they saw. Who cares if it's 600 a day or six a day? You have to start somewhere, right? Somebody else says, sir, you're saying the border is exactly the same way as it was under President Obama Harris. I'm just trying to find the truth of what's going on, what was promised, what's being delivered, and what's likely to happen. Because people today want to look at it as winning or losing. It's a zero-sum game. There's no nuance. There's no gray. It's all black or white. Either we're doing it or we're not doing it. We're winning or we're losing. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are people being removed from the United States, including on some of these military flights that, you know, they've been promoting. The military flights, actually, look at the carrying capacity of those flights, are actually lower than some of the other flights that don't get as much news coverage. So, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they've got 13 planes. You know, the DOD has loaned four planes to them. You know, that's their limit. I mean, that's so, you know, you got to hire more people, you know, get more planes. There's always going to be a limit, and we've obviously hit the limit for planes. And if you look at the detention capacity, you got to hold somebody while they're waiting for removal. The detention capacity of the United States for holding people who are here illegally is 41,500. So you have to change the law. You have to appropriate the money if this is what you want to do.
So when you say capacity, that is not by statute, that's by logistics and what they have the facilities for?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So they're looking to change that. They talked about Guantanamo. But look, I mean, flying someone to Guantanamo isn't a lot cheaper than flying someone to their home country. So it's, there are opportunity costs no matter how you try to slice this, that, you know, you have to deal with the logistics and the reality. You can't just deal in, well, you know, I signed a piece of paper and it says that everyone should be removed. That's really not how it works.
Is anything in the works to devote more assets, spend more money,
yeah,
provide more of this, more of that? Are they working on any of that as far as you know?
Oh, yes. Congress is considering spending a lot more money on this issue. We don't know how much or what it will look like, but that is definitely something that members of Congress are considering and working on. A request has obviously been made by the president for this issue.
So when somebody shows up at the border claiming asylum, they want asylum because they're being persecuted politically, has anything changed with that as far as the way they're handled?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, you know, by the end of the Biden administration, asylum was effectively banned already. And there isn't, like, a dramatic difference between, yes, the numbers are down, but, look, they were down in 2017 as well when President Trump came into office. So perception is probably even more important than policy when it comes to people showing up in the future, people coming now. They think, okay, let's see what happens with this guy. You know, is he actually going to follow through on his promises this time? But last time they hung back, they waited, but then we saw them come again in 2018 and 2019. Then it went down again. It came back up again by the end of his term in office. They were arresting about 70,000 per month. Right now, this last month was 30,000 in January. Obviously, that's two-thirds Biden, but that gives you kind of the scale of what we're talking about.
And the other question I have is, for those that are caught crossing rather illegally, what's changed, or has anything changed?
For those who are caught crossing illegally?
Yes.
Yeah, so again, these are people those are the people who are ending up on some of these military flights. Many of them are just being returned right to Mexico. Right now, the numbers are very low. I mean, you're talking, a few hundred a day compared to several thousand per day at the height of the border crisis in 2022 and 2023. So it's much more manageable for the Border Patrol than it was in the past. But you have, no one's really sure, but 13, 15 million in the United States, and that's really going to be, the challenge that they're focused on for the next 4 years.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. David Beard, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute. We come back, we'll talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, as we always do on Thursday mornings. Bird flu kind of making itself known around the nation. We're at the Host Committee's Media Center on Media Row in the Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. I'm Tommy Tucker, back in a flash. Time now, 6:30, WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. We are live here at the Convention Center, Radio Row. I know the NFL traffic is going to build up later on. We'll grab some people as they walk by. And go to NFL One Pass. Go get the NFL One Pass app, and they'll get alerts on everything that's going on throughout the day. I signed up for that. That's the official site of the National Football League, and it'll keep you in tune with everything that's happening. Mike Strain joins us now, Louisiana Commissioner of Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Mike Strain?
Man, I am doing well. I bet you're telling everybody to go down and get some good seafood, to go down to one of the Brennan's restaurants. Or there's so many to choose from, or Drago's. I mean, you're very close to Drago's, Tommy, right there.
Yeah.
In the hotel. And just, look, now is the time, right? All these people coming in, they want genuine Louisiana seafood, some of those big oyster and shrimp po'boys. And, and maybe a little crawfish etouffee, a little fried catfish. They want that total experience. And I know you are busy. So, man, thank goodness. I sure hate to know I have to drive to come see you today. But I think it's going to be great. It's going to be a great weekend. And I saw in one article that they estimated that 500,000 pounds of just soft-shell crabs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just incredible. Oh, what? Soft-shell crab po'boy? The problem is once these people from all over the United States come here and eat, they're going to come back on a regular basis.
That's good.
Yes.
That's what we want.
Absolutely. That's what we say. We will eat all weekend, and then we'll sell some of the rest.
There you go. Well, it happens with crabs in Maryland. You know that. Maybe sometimes we sell what we could eat.
That's our crabs in Maryland.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
We fish them here and send them up there.
And big old number ones.
Maryland crabs.
What those big giant ones? Number ones, they call them? Hard to get the number
ones. That's right. They are beautiful.
Let's talk about bird flu before we go any further, because now we're hearing about bird flu in Nevada and making a reference to Louisiana. What's going on with bird flu, and what could this mean in terms of poultry and egg prices, and then how do you prevent it from spreading, all that? Mike, we've been talking about this for a long time.
Yes, the situation is that there are now, as of today, 4 new herds in Nevada that have the same strain. They're called clades. Same strain of virus that was found in Louisiana, in which the gentleman, passed away. And it's a new strain. This is the first time, though, it's ever been seen in cattle. And it's D1.1. And the issue is these cattle are now getting sick with respiratory signs. So this virus tends to want to mutate in different areas to this particular strain. That's one of the things with the flu virus. It will mutate, or we call it reassort. And we're very concerned now because this particular strain is more conducive to causing the cattle to get really sick with respiratory signs, but also to infect people. So So good biosecurity is the key. And we're also hoping that we push through and get a vaccine where we can vaccinate our livestock, our poultry, you know, our cattle, and the farm workers that are exposed. And so, again, we're going to keep a close eye on this one, because with the bird flu that just started, you know, the original bird flu started in three herds in the Texas Panhandle. And it was a different strain, but now it's in you know, almost 1,000 herds, you know, in 20 states. And so it's something we have to be, we got to take this serious. You know, we just can't turn a blind eye, and we need all the science, but we're going to have to make some hard decisions, you know, if we need to, you know, so we've got to stop transmission. And look, I'm in favor of vaccinating the wild birds, you know, and that's been discussed, you know, that when those birds, ducks go into Canada to use, you know, fogging machines or whatever to try to vaccinate them. So, you know, we are concerned. We don't have that in Louisiana. But the issue is this is not a strain of the virus that we are comfortable with being in the environment.
So when you say push through, are you talking about push through regulations, push through scientific research? Because we've heard so much about...
All of the above.
Okay, so we've heard so much about vaccines with RFK Jr. and his hearings and everything else. Does he have anything to do, or does that have anything to do with this, or is it a completely different department?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He can either lean forward so we can rapidly develop and deploy vaccines in livestock. You know, if you eat beef, those cattle are vaccinated. Before they go into feedlots, they are certified that they've been vaccinated and protected. Your pork has been vaccinated and protected. Your dog, your cat, your horse is vaccinated and protected. But we don't vaccinate our poultry. We have avian influenza vaccines, not these necessarily strains, but we have general vaccine that may give some protection, but we won't vaccinate our birds. You've seen the price of eggs. We've lost between 8 and 10% of our total egg-laying population in the last 3 to 4 months. I mean, eggs, you know, in a lot of places, eggs are almost $1 a piece simply because we've lost the hens, and we won't do it because we're worried about that our foreign trade partners will not buy our poultry if we vaccinate. They buy our steaks. They buy our ground meat. They buy our pork. You know what? I think it's time that we vaccinate our chickens. We need to stop this disease.
So is this, I don't want to get you in a political conversation here because that's not my intent, okay. But is it about policy here with RFK Jr.? Does he handle any of this, or are you concerned about that at all or not? I'm just worried about, as a consumer, what we should be concerned with.
Well, it will be in his, you know, in his cup of tea. So before it has not been. It's been about international politics, why we haven't vaccinated our poultry. But now, on the front line, do we develop a mRNA vaccine, which we can develop quickly, you know, and other vaccines to vaccinate our poultry? And now looking at vaccinating our beef, you know, our cattle and our dairy cattle, or does he say, no, we're not going to do that? So we need them to lean forward with sound science. But yes, when you're talking about his influence over the Food and Drug Administration and, you know, the USDA and all the other things, that can have a major impact. And, you know, we're going to lean forward. We're going to, you know, say, look, we need to vaccinate because, one, you know, we don't, you know, if eggs double again, we're all in trouble. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is there's a lot of virus out there. And now you have seen that different strains are, you know, are from spontaneous either mutation or when the genetics reassort within a person or an animal, it comes out differently. Mm. So we need to get ahead of this.
Let me take a break, Mike.
And we need to vaccinate. We need to stop.
We come back because in addition to egg prices, then you got, you know, I saw the movie Rams, I mean, I told you about where they have guys in Australia and the sheep get infected and they got to destroy the entire herd. If you talk about,
correct,
and you can come back and talk about how many hens have already been, had to be destroyed in the country and what effect that could have, because you don't just recover from that immediately. We're talking to Mike Strain about bird flu in Nevada. We'll also talk about crawfish and tariffs and seafood testing and more when we come back. Mike Strain, our good friend, the Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. We're at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in the Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. Time now, WWL Traffic. 57, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. We're live at the Convention Center. And we're talking about, Mike, we were talking about bird flu and destroying livestock, but I want to move along quickly if we can. I was talking to A.C. Cooper about shrimp testing and enforcement of regulations and just the outrageous amount of seafood that's being sold is from the Gulf, and it's not in restaurants. Thoughts?
That's right. As I was listening to you, and I know A.C., and he's one of probably the biggest advocate for Louisiana shrimp that I know of. And so last legislative session, a number of bills were filed that have now become law. And we are really, really looking to figure out how we can, you know, curb the illegal imports. In other words, those that are contaminated with antibiotics and other things, also illegal labeling. So it's in, there are a number of different laws and a number of different agencies working simultaneously. And so for the labeling laws, any imported shrimp or crawfish where the package is deceiving. In other words, it says Boudreaux's crawfish, and you got, you know, a shrimp boat on there, and believe it or not, they put a shrimp boat on a crawfish packet. And then you have a scene of rural Cajun life, and when you flip over and you look on the back, it's imported. Well, under that, that my inspectors are looking at these packages, then I have to make the final decision. Then in that particular case, they got to put in 30-point font, which is big font, you know, or label on the front of the package. Failure to do so. First offense is $15,000, second is $25,000, third and thereafter are $50,000 per offense. And so this legislation was passed last year, went into law in July. We sent the 60 major importers, every importer we could find, we sent them a letter, said this is the law and this is what we're going to do. So that's one. Secondly, we are now testing for antibiotics at the state lab, the analytical lab. Tests are underway. We expect the first results in about a week, and this is an accredited regulatory lab. And so we started that. That all went into effect on about the 20th of January. And so we're testing, and these the results will be then sent over to Lieutenant Governor's Office, Seafood Safety Task Force, Wildlife and Fisheries, and Department of Health and Hospitals.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure as always. Mike Strain, Director of the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Wait, what I got? I'm confused here. Department of Agriculture and Forestry. I'm sorry, Mike.
And aquaculture.
I'm sorry, Mike. You got so much under your purview. We'll be back, WWL. All right, 7:14, here we go. We're going to talk about the history of the Super Bowl. And I said earlier, I was a little bitty baby boy going to Belchase, which is where I now live. A lot of y'all think Belchase is at the end of the world. It's not. At that point, it was. Going to a cousin's house in Belchase, putting an antenna way up on the roof is what they did to pirate a signal out of Baton Rouge to pick up the Super Bowl so we could watch the game that was being broadcast in New Orleans. That was when Kansas City beat Minnesota. So 2 years later, the Super Bowl was here again. Baltimore was playing Dallas in 1972, and I had to go down the street with another antenna way up on the roof to a neighbor's house to pirate the signal out of Baton Rouge. The game originally, as y'all know, started with both networks covering it. The game didn't sell out, and what's happened since then has been an American phenomenon. Robert Fliegler joins us, a professor of history at the University of Mississippi. Talk about it. How you doing, Professor?
Pretty good, thank you.
Let's talk about the history of this game. First of all, when it comes to national championships games and sporting events, it's the biggest of them all, other than the World Cup, accurate or not?
Yeah, I think the biggest in the United States. The World Cup is probably still bigger internationally. But, yeah, certainly in the United States, nothing even comes remotely close to the Super Bowl now. It's left everything else in its wake in the last 60 years, almost 60 years now.
And I guess the difference is Super Bowl is one game. The World Cup's a series of games. When it comes to the origins, and I talked back about the early days, take us through the progression of the Super Bowl, how it's gotten bigger, why it's gotten bigger, and why it's become an American phenomenon.
Well, I think you have to go back to the beginning when football in the early 60s wasn't the biggest sport in America. It wasn't this dominant force in the culture. Baseball was number one, and you had the emergence of the AFL as a challenger to the NFL. And one of the architects of the AFL was Lamar Hunt, who was the owner of the Kansas City Chiefs, whose son is now the owner of the Chiefs, who are playing the game this week. And he was one of the instrumental forces behind the AFL. And when the merger came between the AFL and the NFL, there was then going to be a championship game between the two leagues. And he sort of offered up the idea of it being called the Super Bowl. And that was not something that Pete Rozelle, who was probably the greatest sports commissioner we've had, he was not too excited about it. And they thought, well, there'll be a better term that'll come up at some point. But by the time of that first Super Bowl in 1967, people were calling it that, and it is stuck. And the game has just grown as the NFL, by the end of the 60s, was the number one sport. And it has grown even further as the NFL has become more and more dominant. And as early as 1974, Norman Vincent Peale said if Jesus Christ were alive, he'd be at the Super Bowl because the event had become so big. And I think what's striking also is there are those of us of a certain age who can remember when the Super Bowl really wasn't usually a very good game. You'd have 2 weeks of hype that would be talking the game up and game up, and then you'd have a rout. And so it was really incredible. But despite that, you know, nowadays the games in the last 20 years or so have been very good. But, you know, it just became this phenomenon that is, you know, the only sort of thing that we all kind of come together and watch.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point that you made about the games being better, because at one point they were blowouts and it was terrible. And I was talking the other day about the 49ers-Denver game here that was over at halftime. I think it was 49-0 back in 1990 or whenever it was. But as of late, and I guess it goes to parity in the National Football League, that means the difference between winning and losing is so close. The difference between getting to the championship game is so minute that you almost guarantee a pretty good game by the time you get to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I think the coming of the salary cap in the mid-90s kind of leavened the competition. And so that the NFC from the early 80s till the late 90s really dominated the game, had 13 straight wins in the Super Bowl. But with the salary cap sort of evening up, now we usually have close games. And even though the Patriots and Tom Brady and the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes have had so many Super Bowl wins, most of them have been pretty taut sort of close games.
Let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about the history of the game against the context of the history of the United States, because I know you're a historian at Ole Miss, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, because it does, I don't know if there's any comparison or not. I know back in the days growing up, you'd watch World War II movies and the code word would be who won the World Series, right? And now I think a lot of American soldiers would get shot because they wouldn't know who won the World Series, because it's not, and I say that not disrespectfully, but you know what I'm saying, because
sure.
Back in the movies, if y'all don't remember, they would say, all right, who won the series, to see if you're an American soldier or not, and they would know because the series was such a big thing. But it seems like, I don't know if there's been anything in American history that would rival the Super Bowl, especially if you look at the way media has become segmented now. But everybody comes together, although Fox has taken a step, and we'll talk about that with the professor as well now, putting it on Tubi to stream it so you don't have to watch it over broadcast or cable television. We're talking to Robert Fleekler, professor of history at the University of Mississippi, about the history of the Super Bowl. More when we come back. And I'd like to hear from y'all on the Elkhorn Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. If you have some memories of some early Super Bowls in New Orleans that you went to. Next half hour, we'll talk to Keith Spira about New Orleans Super Bowl halftime shows. I'm Tommy Tucker at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in the Convention Center. It's powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. Back in a flash, time for traffic now on WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back at the Host Committee's Media Center here, covering the big game. We're talking to Robert Fleekler, a professor of history at the University of Mississippi, about the history of the Super Bowl and how it's grown into such a phenomenon. Professor, against the context of the country, is there anything that rivals the Super Bowl and its growth from what it started as to what it's become?
Certainly hard to see a lot of things in sort of modern U.S. history that compare. I mean, as you know, when TV emerged really in the 50s, it's when there were only the three networks, you know, we all watched the same TV shows. And that was, you know, kind of true until the 1980s, and, you know, you had something like the Dallas cliffhanger of who shot J.R. Ewing. The last episode of MASH, the series finale, was for years the most watched TV program in American history. And we used to sometimes as a nation come together to watch the same, you know, event TV show. But those days are long past. And the Super Bowl is the one thing that, you know, everyone will be watching. It, because even people who are not football fans will be going to Super Bowl parties. And it almost doesn't even matter what the matchup is, right? The World Series baseball got fortunate this year. Was very excited to have the Dodgers and the Yankees in the World Series, and that really increased interest. And, of course, the NFL is certainly happy to have Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs back in the game. But if they were not, the audience would probably only barely be affected, because it's just an event, and it's really a secular holiday, in a sense. But the country shuts down that's for Super Sunday.
We are very divided as a country. That's cliche almost to say it now. But is there something to be said for a mutually shared event like this where it can be uniting, even though it is a competitive event?
Yeah, no, I think there's no question about it. And I think sporting events, sports is kind of the one last area where that occurs. And again, just like in everything else, now you have a much more fractured sports climate, not necessarily a divisive one, but there's so many sports, there's so much to watch. And like I said, and yet, you know, the Super Bowl is this one thing left that kind of is the thing that everybody does. And I think that that is good for, you know, for three and a half hours this Sunday. We all will be, you know, sitting together watching United and doing the same thing. And I think that is healthy.
So they say you got to learn from history to predict the future, right? Or at least something along those lines. Or maybe I just made that up, Professor, either way. But where do you see this game 10 years from now and a country 10 years from now, if the past is any predictor of the future?
Well, the NFL has weathered a lot of storms in the last decade or so. And I think many people, including myself, I would have thought the concussion issues might have had a long-term effect, might have affected the game's popularity. But it just seems to keep going. It doesn't. There's no sign that the NFL, and hence the Super Bowl, is slowing down. You know, it's the one thing that viewership is falling for everything else, but the NFL is holding up better than anything. And so I can't see any reason right now to suggest that a decade from now, the Super Bowl won't still be the event, or maybe even bigger in some ways than it is today, like you say, with streaming and further internationalization of the audience. And it you know, you can't predict things, but when in a world like I've said, where everything else is sort of getting more fractured in the culture, in the popular culture, the NFL just keeps churning on and distancing itself from pro basketball and pro baseball as the biggest thing in the country. And the Super Bowl, I think in 1986, Game 7 of the World Series, very big World Series, and the Red Sox and the Mets got 80% of the audience of the Super Bowl. And I would have to look, but I would, if a baseball game, a Game 7, could get a third of the audience of the Super Bowl today, they'd be fortunate.
Wow. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate the time and the insight. I really do. I know you'll be watching on Sunday. Robert Fliegler, Professor of History at the University of Mississippi, talking about the history of the Super Bowl and how it's grown into the biggest event, not just sporting event, but the biggest event in the United States and maybe second only to the World Cup in the world. Keith Spira joins. We come back, reporter for the Times-Picayune. Dean Blandino joins us now, Fox Sports NFL rules analyst, former NFL official. How you doing, Dean?
I'm doing good.
It's nice to see you in person.
Yeah,
after seeing you on TV every Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, great to be here.
Tell me, first of all, what it's like to call one of these games, because we sit and have you ever officiated a Super Bowl or not?
I've been the replay official for a couple of Super Bowls, yeah.
Let's talk about that. How quickly can you turn things around? Is it a group decision? Is it one guy deciding this? Because a lot is weighing on us,
A lot. It's a collaborative decision. You have the referee, the replay official, the command center official, replay supervisor. So you're all looking at the play, looking at the pertinent angles, and then kind of discussing it and then coming to a decision. And ultimately, it would be the command center, if there is any kind of dispute or debate about it, they would make the final call.
Is there often, do you have a hard time finding a consensus on, say, what's a catch, what's not a catch?
Usually, no. I mean, for the most part, everybody's on the same page. There are always going to be those plays where maybe there's a little gray area, because it's such, catch, no catch is subjective.
Right.
Control and time element and things like that, football move. So you do get sometimes some conversation, but usually we're on the same page.
What do you think of the rules when it comes to what's a catch, what's not? I hear you and the announcers sometimes talk about, I don't know what's a catch, what isn't a catch, and you use the word subjective just now. You got people, I hate to say it, but the NFL's embraced gambling, so there's a lot of money involved in whether it's a catch or whether it's not a catch, not just with prop bets, but with over totals, over, under, everything else, yardage, is there anything you would like to see done, or you would advise them to do with the rules to make it a little bit more objective?
Yeah, that's always the goal. If you can make things more objective and make it simpler for the officials, because the more subjectivity, the more gray area, that makes it tougher. So, as you think about rules changes and things like that, that's kind of what you want for your officials. Because like you said, there's so much riding on these games, and it's not just, who wins and loses sometimes. A lot of people care about those bets, like you said.
When it comes to the things like penalties that are not reviewable, correct?
Yeah.
How hard is it for you to be honest? Because, you've been on the field, right? And it's hard to make that split-second decision, and I'll get to that in a minute, because that's a completely different animal. People don't understand, and I think you guys do a hell of a job of getting it right, because it's happening in real time. And it's easy to go back and go frame by frame and see what's going on, but I don't know. You got seconds to react to
this. You just said it, and that's the disconnect between on-field officiating and how we look at the game. An on-field official is going to make the decision at full speed from their perspective, and then we get to evaluate their decision based on four or five different slow motion angles. So, and if you've ever stood on the sideline for an NFL game, it is fast, and these things are happening really quickly, and that's what makes it a very challenging profession.
Not only is it fast, but it's scary, because, man, if you've been on the sideline of a game...
Yeah, you could be in the way.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
That's like tractor trailers running around. I always said anything that big moving that fast ought to have Southern Pacific painted on the side of it, right? Dean Blandino is nice enough to spend some time with us. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll pick it up. We come back. Dean, if you don't mind, we have a text screen where people can... text in their questions.
Yeah, sure.
So
sure.
We'd like, if you have any questions about NFL officiating, here's your chance, 504-260-1870. Dean Blandino is our guest. He's a Fox Sports rules analyst for the NFL. It's 7:42, 18 till 8. We're live here at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in the Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith & Soso. Tommy Tucker back in a flash with more from Dean Blandino here on WWL. 8 back with Dean Blandino. He's going to be in the booth. He's a replay official, the rules official for Fox Sports. He'll be in the booth with Tom Brady and Kevin Burkhardt calling the game on Sunday. How hard is it for you to look at a replay? And first of all, do you, Dean, just call it balls and strikes like you see it, and then let whatever unfolds in New York unfold in New York? Is that how?
Yeah, that's pretty much the approach. I try to explain the rule. Here's what they're looking at, so the viewers understand kind of what's going on. But then you've got to give your opinion. So I try to look at it and say, hey, if I were making this decision, here's what I would do. And then if it comes back different, then I can explain maybe a different perspective. But you just try to call it like you see it.
I don't want you to name any names or call anybody out. But have there been instances where it was obvious that the coaches didn't know the rules?
Well, there's been situations, especially with replay, where they throw a challenge flag and it's not a reviewable play. So you're always working with the coaches on that, especially when replay was new. Mm-hmm. I think right now they've done a really good job. Every team has somebody that's responsible to help the head coach. They're upstairs usually in the coach's box. Hey, we got to challenge this, or here's the rule here. So it's gotten a lot better than where it was.
And it does change during the playoffs, does it not? And especially during the Super Bowl, where an official is assigned to either a coach or a coaching staff on the sideline and in the booths as well to help them with the rule interpretation, keep everything moving along.
Yeah, in the postseason, you have alternate officials who are not in the regular season. So those alternate officials, there's one assigned to each sideline that will work with the head coach, and that can help them get that information. So it really helps in the postseason to have those.
And when it comes to expedited replay, one question I always had as a fan is, why can't we do this every game?
All the time. Yeah. I know. Look, some decisions take a little longer. I think the league has done a good job with expediting some of the reviews, because that's the biggest thing. You don't want to be standing around waiting. And if you have the video, let's make the decision and keep the game moving.
Let me get to this, because 1,000 people are texting in on it. We did 2 weeks on it after it happened. The famous no call against the Rams.
Yes.
It sucked. It is what it is. A long time ago.
Yes.
But is there any way you could alter the rules to prevent that from happening in the future? Because some things have changed. Right after Garrett Hartley's field goal in the NFC Championship, they changed the rules. They changed the onside kick rules. We had Thomas Morstead here yesterday. Anything they could do to prevent something like that from happening?
Well, you know, they did change the rule after the no call, and the next year they had pass interference that was reviewable, and it didn't really go very well. And I think they kind of struggled with finding a consistent standard. I think you could put something back in place and have replay help with those types of decisions, but ultimately that comes down to the officials on the field and getting them in the right position and on the same page to make that call.
Somebody said, please ask the tough question, was it pass interference? It was,
well,
without doubt, pass interference.
Clearly pass interference.
Let me ask you this. If Tommy Lewis, I think was a guy, Tommy Lee Lewis was a player, if he flops on that play and he lays down there as though he's hurt, do you think he gets that call?
I don't think so. Officials are going to officiate the play, not the aftermath. I just think those officials from their angles didn't think it was a foul. Obviously, that was wrong. It should have been a flag, should have had multiple flags, and that's something I know that people here in New Orleans especially are not over yet.
This is a good question, and I've always wondered about that as well, how a coach can win a challenge, but yet you only get three, because it would seem as though if you correct a mistake, then it shouldn't count against you. You should keep your challenges as long as you keep correcting mistakes. Thoughts?
Yeah.
It would delay the game too much?
I think that's the key. I think you try to keep it limited to where the big plays the coach could challenge, and you don't want to keep going, because then they're going to challenge every little thing, and then we're going to have a bunch of unnecessary stops.
Somebody wants to know about objectivity when it comes to holding penalties, and you know the cliche, you can call holding on every call, and would that ever be anything that would be subject to a review or anything like that?
That's hard, because like you said, I think there's an opportunity to call holding on every play because there is a lot of grabbing that takes place on the offensive line. But then you have to consider other factors. Does it have an impact on the play, right? Is it at the point of attack? Because if it's a hold all the way on one end of the field and the run is going the other way, there's no advantage or disadvantage there. So I think that's the toughest thing with holding in terms of making it reviewable, understanding all the factors that go into what is actually a foul.
On an unrelated note, I was at the Pelicans-Celtics game on Friday night. I don't know how the hell NBA officials call games, because they have
so
hands
tough.
All over each other.
So
I don't
tough.
Know. Do you understand it?
Basketball is, I think it's probably the hardest game to officiate, because there's we talk about opportunity to call holding. There's so much opportunity in basketball with all the contact to call fouls, and how do they... And I'm not a basketball rule expert.
No, but you understand
expert,
what I'm saying.
But as an official,
I want to ask you that.
It's hard. It's
and I know
really
you got to go, but real quick, what about putting a chip in the football when it comes to first down and that kind of thing?
They are testing that. There is a chip in the football. There's a lot of factors there where it's not like tennis where it's just the ball and the line. You've got a lot of bodies, right? You got to find the football, you know, in that sometimes mass of bodies. When is the knee down? When did the official blow the whistle for forward progress? So I think there's other things that go into it, but I think the league is going to continue to test, and we may see that technology at some point in the future.
Your people are telling my people you got to go, but I got to ask you real quick. Do you do anything to prepare for a game? Do you watch game film of the two teams?
Sure.
Look for tendencies,
yes,
or what?
Yeah, you look at game film. You look at tendencies. You look at what they like to do. Maybe it's short yardage. How do they play on the defense side?
But with an eye toward penalties?
Do they play more aggressively in the secondary? Is there going to be more opportunity for holding or pass interference, things like that? So that's kind of what you're looking for. And kind of what the officiating crew is looking at now as they prepare for the game.
My people are coming into my periphery now, which means it's time for you
to
go.
Okay, your people will call my people and we'll do lunch
Dean,
sometime.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure meeting you, and you do a great job. Have a great call on Sunday of the game.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Dean Blandino, Fox Sports Rules Analyst. He'll be in the booth with Kevin Burkhardt and Tom Brady on Sunday. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. Can I get a picture? 837, 23 till 9. One thing I love about when we're here is that you walk around, you never know who you're going to bump into. So I'm walking down Radio Row, and I see a guy, and I say, man, you got to be somebody. Who are you? Because he's a big, giant man. He says, I'm nobody. Don't worry about me. Come to find out it's Chris Long is who it is.
I'm Kyle Long.
Kyle Long. I'm sorry.
We're getting there.
Yeah, well, we got some computer issues, and we're trying to get through it all. Tell me what's your capacity here. You working for whom?
I'm here with CBS Sports. I get to do their pregame show every Sunday out of New York, and it's a lot of fun to get to work with a lot of cool people, former players, coaches, and obviously some media folks. But being here, like you were saying, you get to run into a lot of folks you see maybe digitally. You never get to see them in person.
Super Bowl is kind of like, for you NFL players, almost like a reunion, I hate to say almost. Or like
it is. You know what? It feels like that. My father-in-law just got he went up to Philly for his college reunion, and the way he's raving about seeing all his buddies and everything's kind of the same way that we handle it here. You know, you work during the day, if we call this work, hanging out, talking ball, and then you go have a couple beers with your buddies at night and get to see old friends, old teammates, guys that maybe you didn't like very much when you played, and then you have share a laugh with them.
So when it comes to broadcasting as opposed to playing, is there any comparison at all in terms of preparation or nerves or anything like that?
I would say nerves. You try to find a way to control that heart rate when they're giving you the countdown to going live, stuff like that. But outside of that, it is nice not to be getting hit in the studio or hitting people. We get to talk ball, hang out with our buddies.
How old are you?
I'm 36.
How is your health? Because normally when we come to these things, I see NFL players walking around and they're shuffling around, right? You seem to be moving around pretty well. And how did you get out? How did you handle playing in the league, getting out of it, et cetera?
Well, I had a stretch of bad luck at the end of my career for about 4 years, landing on IR, just getting rolled up, stuff like that. As an offensive lineman, there's a lot of bodies. That wasn't an indication of my overall health. I just got caught in some bad spots. So when I was done playing and people stopped falling on my legs, I got healthier, and I was able to move around a bit. I played golf for a few years. I just took up tennis. Tennis is a great game.
I saw you looking at the PXG 10 over there. They got a virtual closest to the whole thing.
That's
you take a
little,
a swing
that's a little above my fiscal head, those is PXG really? Clubs. You know, they're expensive. That's like the Rolls Royce of golf clubs.
Oh, I don't know about that. Your dad is Howie Long, of course,
he is,
right?
Yeah. Yes.
You guys are going to spend some family time here or not?
He's working. They got,
I understand
Fox
that.
Fox is covering
right.
it. So I know where he's staying. I'll probably end up go seeing him this afternoon. But he's a busy man right now.
For people that don't know about the violence in the trenches in the NFL, and I know somebody played offensive line at LSU and had him pick me up and tore me around like a rag doll the other day, just because we tend to think that, you know, we can compete, we really can. And explain, if you will, Kyle Long, the violence that goes on in that pit.
Well, I mean, it's as violent as it looks. I think the one thing that's lost on people that are viewing on television or listening over the radio is just how big these guys are in person.
Well, I can tell you, he's a big man. How tall are you?
I'm about 6'6", and I was about 340 when I played. I'm 300 now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I would say this. It's the thing that's hard. The hardest thing about playing in the NFL is convincing yourself prior to every snap that you're going to go try to move somebody against their will, because I'll tell you what, it doesn't always feel too great, even on the inflictor of violence.
But as an offensive lineman, and we always hear, you know, as fans, that there's nothing more what's the word I'm thinking of, fulfilling to an offensive lineman than late in the game imposing your will on that other guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah, when everybody in the stadium, including the other team, knows you're going to run the ball and you can still do so successfully. And I think about the Philadelphia Eagles and the Saints with Jahri Evans, Carl Nix, and that group.
Right.
That's a damn good feeling. And fans take pride in that when they get to watch their boys go out and do that.
So when it comes to that moment in the game, is it about technique? Is it about size, strength, or is it about, because the margin is that thin, right, between one and the other? Or is that just about will when you get right down to it?
A lot of it is will. A lot of it is that conditioning that you put yourself through all offseason so that you can maintain that level of technique even when your body's exhausted. Like I was telling you, I played tennis. I just started playing tennis about a month and a half ago, and I'll be doing drills. I look great for the first 10 reps, and then we get to 11, 12, 13, and I'm falling apart. I can't find the center of the racket, and I'm standing up straight. That's what happens to athletes when they're out there playing football, is, you know, they get tired and they sink to the level of their preparation. So if you're prepared, you can be violent over the course of four quarters.
One thing I've always wondered about as a parent, and this is about you, not your dad, all right? What's it like growing up with an NFL player? Your dad's in the Hall of Fame, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Is there an intense pressure you felt as a child growing up? And I'm not trying to knock your dad or anything. I'm just talking about in general the experience of, you know, you're a big guy. You're expected to play football, I guess. Were there expectations to play football your whole life?
Well, he always told me football's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I didn't start playing until I was 16. And he made sure that I was fully committed to playing once, you know. He didn't want me to be half in, half out. Right. So he's like, there ain't no messing around in this game. So if you're going to play it the right way. And I did from then on. But you said pressure. I would say that it was more just gravitational pull taking mm-hmm. me towards the field because I had seen that he had done it before and my older brother was doing it, Chris. Yeah, man, he said you're gonna protect your younger brother who's the quarterback and you'll rush the passer on defense, and that's about that.
Overall, your health is good. Are you feeling good?
Yeah, feel good.
Good for you. Nice meeting you, man. Thanks
Pleasure
for coming
to meet
by.
You, Tommy.
And that's so humble of you to say. Who are you? I'm nobody. Don't worry about me.
I'm just a guy playing a
just
guy.
Just a guy. Yeah, all right. Me too. It's 8:43. Tim, I lost track of what's going on back there. I think we're taking a break. 8:49, 11 till 9. Councilmember J.P. Morrell joins us. I guess I should tell you where we are in case you don't know. After all week, we're at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in the Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So, covering the big game. J.P. Morrell now in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino Power Seat. How you doing, J.P.?
I'm good. How are you doing?
You didn't know that, did you? You didn't know, well,
that's a lot.
There you are. You're in the Treasure Chest virtual power seat, so I hope you win. Let's talk about the city being ready for the Super Bowl. I know you've done a lot of walking around, involved in the preps, thoughts about security and everything else. And also, how much of a wild card, as far as you're hearing, is President Trump's coming to the game? Because I'm thinking, well, on one hand, it could make it more complicated, but on the other hand, maybe it's just as secure can be anyway. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, so the security, we are the most secure. This is the most secure Super Bowl we've probably ever seen. So as far as security concerns about game day, I want to stress to the public and remind everyone throughout the rest of the week and Super Bowl, be patient because that security comes with a whole lot of inconvenience about navigating and getting around downtown. So there's that. As far as the president coming on Sunday, obviously the city always welcomes when a president visits, but there are some things tied in with that. For example, there's going to be a very significant period where a lot of different transportation is suspended around the city. And something that was brought to our attention yesterday is the ferry will be shut down between Algiers and New Orleans, the East Bank, New Orleans. So, yeah, we want the president to visit. Yes, I think it does heighten the security, but there will be a cascading amount of delays around the Superdome and the greater New Orleans area because, as you know, the president's route from the airport to the Superdome will be secure, which means they will stop all traffic. And simultaneously, in that window in which he's there and which he's present, they suspend travel, traffic, air, water around the area he's in. So I just want to make everyone aware that because the president's attending the game, it's going to exasperate a lot of the delays and challenges. So in an effort to avoid that, if you're going to enjoy the game or if you're going downtown for any reason in that window, early is better. Because if you're planning on hopping on the highway and getting there right before the game or maybe getting downtown by halftime, you are going to be sitting in your car.
You
Just
know,
be aware of that.
It's a great... How can I explain this? It's a trade-off, but it's a great thing that's happening for the city is what I started to say, but it's a trade-off because you can't expose what's going on with the president because of the security measures in place. However, if people want to avoid it, there is no way that they can really go to check and see that either, is there?
No. I mean, basically, because of the way the Secret Service deals with details for every president, you don't get like a specific time or specific window of time in which you'll arrive or depart. So my suggestion to everyone is that since it's generally aware now that he is attending the game, you are better off going to your favorite bar, restaurant, or coffee shop and posting up early to avoid that drama because the likelihood he's going to arrive, any VIP is going to arrive 3-4 hours before the game is probably not realistic, but we don't know. So to everyone who's going to be down there, whether you're working or whether you're coming to party or whatever, get down there early because when you're trying to get down, I mean, because it's not, as you know, Tommy, they don't just close down the I-10. They closed down every cross street that could impact his travel going to and from a location. So it's gonna make the travel situation in downtown New Orleans, I mean, really from Kenner through downtown New Orleans, even more perilous than it already is. So if you're going somewhere, get there early. That's all I can tell you. Get there as early as possible and enjoy yourself, and don't be stuck in traffic ruining the fact that you decide to do your hair or to try a different coat on or, you know, to try and...
Well, I will not be doing my hair, JP, first of all. And secondly, if anybody knows about posting up at your favorite place, it's JP Morrell. I'm just kidding. Let's talk about this mayor with the money for the school system, and I'm confused about this whole thing about where the money was supposed to go. If the money was collected, why doesn't the city have it now? If it was supposed to be $20 million and they decided on less, or if it was supposed to be $36 million, they decided on $20 million. Where'd the $16 million go? Take me through all of this, if you can. I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but you are talking about a significant amount of money here. JP? Tim, is JP Morrell there or not? JP, do you have me on mute? JP, do you have me on mute? You know, in times like this, I'm reminded of a joke. Katie, who works with New Orleans and Company, is standing there. Katie, listen to this joke, if you will. A guy jumps out of an airplane. A guy goes to take skydiving lessons, and they tell him, look, jump out of the plane, pull a ripcord. If nothing happens, pull a second ripcord, and then there'll be a truck there to take you back to the airport. So the guy jumps out of the plane, pulls the first ripcord, nothing happens. Pulls the second ripcord, nothing happens. And as he's hurtling toward the ground at a high rate of speed, he says, you know what? I'll bet that truck's not going to be there either. That's what I think of at moments like this. JP Morrell is back with us. Let's talk about the settlement with, I understand what's going on. $20 million of illegal settlement, $36 million was collected. I don't know what happened to the $16 million. Take me from the beginning on this.
I think it's very confusing. I think the reporting was very confusing. The issue is this: the school board is in a lawsuit with the city since 2019 because the city has illegally collected an administrative fee on millage collection. That exposure, Tommy, is like $150 million.
Wait, the city illegally collected what?
An administrative fee. So the voters voted on a millage to go to the school board. The city had been shaving money off the top as an administrative fee. That is illegal. And that was the lawsuit. And the exposure to the city was anywhere from $100 to $150 million. The school board separately had a crisis this year in that they miscounted how much money they would have, and they overestimated how much money was in their coffers. The council, the school board, and the administration, really led by the council and Joe DiRusso, reached a settlement on that $100 to $150 million suit. That settlement included $20 million in cash for this year, as well as a commitment that the city would continue to pay for a bunch of programs for kids, like mental health services, education for the incarcerated youth. That is about $10 million a year over 10 years. So what we did is we settled a $150 million suit for around $100 to $120 million paid over 10 years.
Well, but wait, in another way, that's money that the school board's not going to get because if you said the city shaved off $100 to $150 million, that's what you told me with an illegal...
Over several years, and part of the settlement was also that the city would stop shaving the money. So we were already on the hook for a substantial amount of money. Now, that shaving was not just under Mayor LaToya Cantrell. That was under previous mayors, too. So they had a lawsuit separately. We settled the lawsuit, and in that lawsuit, they got $20 million cash to plug their shortfall. The amount of their shortfall they've estimated is $36 million. But Tommy, that's where the reporting gets confusing, because whatever that shortfall is immaterial to the council and the city. That $20 million is just the cash portion of the settlement of a lawsuit. That's it.
JP,
those two amounts do not really relate.
I only got 2 minutes here, but I got to understand, the city operates under charter. How do you shave $100 to $150 million off of a millage and do it from administration to administration, and nobody knows about this and nobody catches this. This boggles my mind. I don't understand how this can happen.
The school board caught it in 2019, which is why they sued. So, I mean, yeah, as you know, I was elected in 2022, and the suit started in 2019, but basically, and it wasn't just the school board. The city, I believe, had also been shaving money from the RTA. And the RTA, they won their lawsuit and got that amount taken off. And so the school board came to us and said, well, the RTA won on this exact same set of facts. And so basically, in order to A, because obviously there's a significant concern with that shortfall, that if it is not plugged by the school board, it will directly negatively impact kids and teachers. Let me just tell
Tim back at the studio this. Tim, bring that music down because I might run a minute late here, and a whole hour has been a disaster anyway. But JP, so you're telling me that two people got in a room, or five people, whomever, got together and said, hey, look, let's shave some money off of this millage and call it an administrative fee and then put it in the city budget somewhere? Because I thought the council was the one that allocated the money.
When it comes to collecting money, Tommy, that is not the council, that's the finance department.
I see. And like I said, the finance department,
and let me be very clear, that happened years ago. I'm talking about probably, and Joe would know the number far more than I. We're talking about 15, 20 years ago when a millage was passed, that this fee was plugged in there and shaved. And then that fee was recently reviewed. A separate case was won by another party saying, Tommy, it makes sense. If voters vote for a millage to go to a school board or go to a different party, the voters didn't okay taking an administrative fee too. So whoever did that, which was years ago, it was incorrect.
Man, I can tell you, Robert Sarazzoli, the original inspector general, told me one time that there were so many revenue streams going into the city that it was kind of like snakes in a hot frying pan moving around. And I'm beginning to understand now what he was talking about. JP, we're out of time. I hope you come back and talk more about this, because it just confuses me. And good luck getting voters to approve another millage if you got shaving of $150 million off. I don't know. 9 o'clock, time for WWL First News.